So, good morning.
Good morning.
This service is partly a response to a New York Times article entitled "The Muddled Tracks of All Those Tears." I'd already been thinking of putting together a program on tears and crying, but annoyance with this article and delight in the flood of readers' comments to it precipitated provided useful encouragement, and the readers' comments were a gold mine of material. The use of the word muddled in the article's title reflected its skepticism about the value of crying. It drew on recent scientific studies to back up the hardly novel but sensible conclusion that crying doesn't always make us feel better and make some people, for example, people who are clinically depressed, feel worse. But what annoyed me most was its fixation on crying as a public act, one intended to elicit a response from an audience. It left me feeling that the article's author, a man, and most of the scientists whose work was cited, mostly men, were uncomfortable witnessing crying. In any event, much of the crying that's done is done in private. Although the article annoyed me, the over 80 readers' comments included some real gems, and I've selected some excerpts to read today. I think they exemplify the disparate ways in which people experience or relate to tears and crying. Bruce wrote, "I cry a lot, as much or more than anyone I know, certainly more than my mother or any of my three wives," which may be why one of the reasons there have been three. "I weep, my preferred term, mostly for joy, particularly for the joy of experiencing real, authentic moments, those rare, beautiful moments of utter poignancy, times when my soul is singing, times when my soul is expressing my most intimate feelings. I don't cry or weep for sadness much, but I observe that others do, as during funerals. I don't weep for loss or grief, although I do sometimes cry for anguish. So when scientists talk about crying in a generalized way, I don't think it means much, but it does get the conversation rolling. Also, when folks say big boys don't cry, I find it odd the three individuals who cry the most in my life are all men. Perhaps it's like Robert Bly says, grief is the way into a man's innermost feelings." Susan wrote, "Gosh, I used to have this ridiculous argument with my mother about letting my daughter cry herself to sleep, which I thought made no sense. She was of the old school, who was taught to ignore crying babies. I, probably a very sensitive new mom, couldn't take it. I always thought crying was the baby's way of communicating until she could talk. I could never ignore it. And years later, I still have a good relationship with my teenage daughter. But I've never been able to talk to my mother in a meaningful way and was very close to my dad. His death seemed like a huge loss in my life, whereas to this day, some basic trust that my mother will hear me is missing from my mental map of the relationship. I think she died a long time ago to me." Peggy wrote, "In Eastern medicine, tears are related to the liver. This makes sense because both good and bad events cause stress, and the body reacts with hormonal shifts, with the liver being the key player. Tears provide a means of releasing the buildup of stress hormones, the actual chemical overload that stress can cause. As someone who used to suffer from migraines, I noticed that the end of each headache was signaled by watering eyes and a bout of crying that had no emotional catalyst. It felt like just like it was, a physical release of toxins. As soon as the tears stopped, I felt calm and knew the worst was over." Cat Dancer wrote, "I'm female. I never understood the tears catharsis bit. Happy tears are fine, but when misery provokes tears, the tears just add to the misery. After a good cry, I'm left with all the unhappiness I had to start out, plus aching red eyes and physical exhaustion. I can never remember tears ever helping me get through a bad patch, but I definitely remember lots of times when crying left me worn out and in total despair. Last time I really cried after a medical diagnosis that later proved incorrect, the doctor said, "You needed to do that." I looked at her in disbelief. I needed that like I needed a ton of bricks falling on me. Carol Ann wrote, "I think this article has left out an important cause of tears, anger. I cry when I'm angry, and perhaps other women do as well. When I was newly married and angry with my husband, I cried. He would misunderstand and comfort me. It was difficult for me to stay angry with someone who was obviously confused, trying to help, and holding me tightly in his arms. This misunderstanding happily ended a number of conflicts. I can't say that this mutual misunderstanding lasted forever, but after 31 years, we're still happily married." Maggie wrote, "I think crying is different for everyone. I've always been able to cry very easily, whether it be tears of sorrow or joy, and whenever I do cry, I always feel better afterwards, although there have been times of deep mourning when I've been totally exhausted. It all depends on the reasons for why one cries and what comprises one's emotional tapestry." Dave wrote, "I don't really like people to see me crying, so I only cry alone in my room or outside when it's raining." Amy wrote, "I found that the SSRIs I take for depression and anxiety make it almost impossible to cry. Sometimes I would like to cry, but the tears just won't come." And finally, Valerie wrote, "Our tears are not only a physical and a psychological phenomenon, but they're also a spiritual phenomenon. They connect us to transcendence, to humanity, nature, creation, God. Some of us understand our tears as another way to pray, so we cry in deep gratitude. No matter how we understand tears, we ought to value them as precious. We ought to pay attention when ours come and when the tears of our fellow human beings come. We ought to try to keep them from coming through political and economic violence, because there are other circumstances of life that will cause our tears and theirs to flow." So I hope that does a good job of exemplifying all the different ways that people make sense of tears and crying. My personal experience with tears and crying has mostly been positive. Once I escaped from a childhood and adolescence that were totally intolerant of boys crying. Crying for me is mostly cathartic. I sometimes cry when pushed to extremes, but mostly tears only come in private or in supportive environments. I perceive crying as helping me work through trauma and find internal balance. On the occasions, relatively rare and typically brought on by external factors, when I'm depressed, I have the physical sensation of a very heavy weight on my brain, pressing down on my brain. While depressed, I find it impossible to cry. And when, sometimes after a day or more, I find a way to get the tears flowing, that marks the point when the depression begins to lift. My most extended period of weepiness was when one of my cats was diagnosed and treated for cancer. My daughter was about 15 years old at the time, and the cat, named Silvery, was notionally her cat, so I was surprised at the depth of feeling that Silvery's illness produced. I had numerous conversations with people, including the vet, in which I was struggling to speak through tears. And I remember a point when my daughter suggested that all my crying was somehow getting in the way of taking care of Silvery. I remember telling my daughter that I was grieving for our dying cat as I went along instead of bottling it up, and that my emoting wasn't interfering with me being there for Silvery from doing what needed to be done. And at the time, I thought she was embarrassed by and for me. But now, after reflection, I'm thinking that she was mostly just trying to keep herself from being overwhelmed with grief, that being around me and me crying just meant that she felt worse, and somehow things just worked differently for her than for me. I'm still not sure why I was so moved by Silvery's illness and death. I'm thinking it was because of her connection with my daughter. She was my daughter's cat. 7 years later, I still often tear up when I speak of Silvery's passing, and I notice that so does my daughter. After Silvery died, and influenced by my extremely incomplete understanding of Mayan beliefs, I found myself imagining her, Silvery, in a little boat, making her way to a sunny afterlife on the other side of a lake of tears, and with my tears pushing her along. And the Mayans have some belief along these lines, as I understand it. Many of my experiences of crying are connected with listening to music, watching films, or reading fiction. That's partly why I used the Kathleen Edwards song to begin today's service, and why I asked Mike, if he could find an arrangement of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah for the Theodore Parker Singers, because these songs routinely bring me to tears, and perhaps they did you as well. When the choir was practicing, several people told me that they had to work through the song a bit so they could sing it without tearing up. When depressed, I sometimes use music to start the tears that will ease the depression. And I don't know if that works for some of you as well. One of my most surprising experiences with tears was when finishing Muriel Barbery's superb novel, The Elegance of the Hedgehog, and I really recommend this. And I was doing this while helping a friend go through and recover from surgery in Chicago. And one of the characters in the book, who's named Renee, had a vivid and rich internal life that for most of her life was unappreciated by the residents of the fancy apartment building in Paris, of which she was concierge. But as the novel progresses, she finds herself opening up to others, living more and more authentically, more and more openly. On my way back home to Manhattan, Kansas, where I lived at the time, I was sitting in a coffee house in Iowa City, savoring the end of the novel, when I was blindsided by its tragic ending. And sorry, spoiler alert, I guess I should say, but still read it. I'd expected and hoped to shed a few tears of joy at the novel's end. Instead, the ending resulted in an unexpected torrent of tears, leaving me feel like I'd been through the ringer. I'm amazed at how real Renee's character seemed to me. I think my response to her life and fate had something to do with the stress of having looked after my friend during and after his surgery. As my tears flowed in that coffee house, literally pouring out, the stress drained out of me. But on reflection, I also came to see my reaction to her fate to be related to the ways in which I felt my life story to be connected with Renee's. Like Renee, I'd had an internal life that in some ways most people were oblivious to. And so reading Barbery's book helped me in my struggle to make sense of and find peace in my life. We live in a society that is generally hostile to tears. Boys are told not to cry, and adults who cry in public are widely thought to be unreliable, incapable. I'm not sure we've come all that far from the day when Ed Muskie's public tears derailed his presidential campaign. Perhaps tears are so threatening because they connect us up with something that we can't fully understand or control, something that's alternately called the unconscious, the soul, or the divine. In the opening words, Henry Ward Beecher wrote that seeing through tears opens reaches in the unknown and reveals orbs which no telescope, however successfully constructed, could do, nay, which brings to view even the throne of God. In the first reading, someone named Cobbett, it's not clear who he or she was, wrote, There is a sacredness in tears. They are not a mark of weakness, but of power. They speak more eloquently than 10,000 tongues. They are the messengers of overwhelming grief, of deep contrition, of unspeakable love. And the second responsive reading asserted that our becoming often waits the nourishment of tears. My wish for all of us is that we can find ways of experiencing tears and crying as positives, as something that enriches our lives, enabling us to be better connected with our souls and with the divine.